Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to a great night here we have with Suspense Radio. I am your host, John Robb, and I'm telling you, we got a very, very exciting show for you tonight. We got authors Homer Hickman coming up here first, and then later we're going to have Andrew Klavan on. So I want to invite everybody to sit back, relax, because 60 minutes. We had 30 minutes the other day, so I almost screwed that one up. But 60 minutes of Suspense Radio will begin right now. Thank you, everybody, again for joining us here on this great Friday evening on November the 12th, 2010. We are coming from you live here on Suspense Radio from Southern California, where it is definitely a chilly, chilly night. I think that Halloween has definitely brought the chills and the thrills in from the weather and not just from, you know, the reading. So we have some announcements that we're going to make here, of course. And so Suspense Magazine's January or December edition is going to be hitting the stores a week later than we normally do just because of Thanksgiving. So we're going to be able to find that. Our on-sale date is December 1st. It might be out before then. It just depends on the bookstore. But it should be populated and everywhere December 1st. And you definitely don't want to miss our Best of 2010. It's going to be a very, very exciting thing that we've done. It took a lot of man hours, a lot of yelling, a lot of screaming, a lot of throwing. We kind of look like the monkeys on the Career Builder ads, if you guys have seen those. It's kind of what we ended up doing. But we did come down and we broke it down into many different genres. We have our top three in such genres as medical thrillers, legal thrillers, romantic suspense, dark urban fantasy, you know, straight thriller suspense, mystery, cozies. So we kind of broke it down because it was just too difficult to just get 10 straight books that we did last year. And then we did go and we took one book from all of those and we made it the best book of 2010. So you want to make sure that you either get the electronic version or the print version, like I said, out on December 1st. Follow it on Facebook to see, you know, what we have going on. Exactly, you know, when we're going to have it. The electronic people get theirs a little bit early. Most of the authors and everybody have been notified, but they're not going to tell. So it's going to be a complete secret until December 1st. We are going to hold that back. So hopefully we also might have a schedule change here for the radio station the day after Thanksgiving. We probably will not have a show. But I want to remind everybody that if we know, you can still go back and listen to all the great shows that we've done here. And by the looks of it, it seems that a lot of people have been doing that. We just had a big surge in downloads and hits and everything else. And I want to make, you know, and it was a great thing. So I also want to say that, you know, it was great yesterday. It was off. It was Veterans Day. Our first guest was in the military, Homer. So we want to make sure that everybody, you know, celebrated Veterans Day. And just because it is one day a year, that does not mean that you should not remember the veterans that are out there right now fighting, you know, for us. And that comes up to where the IPO or the ISO tour that was going on by ITW is going on now. And David Morrell is talking about that along with Steve Barry and James Rollins and Andy Harp. We are going to have all of those authors come on to talk about their experience over there, with the troops and how they, how everything happened and what exactly they did. So it's going to be a great time. Steve Barry is actually going to be the first one on November the 23rd. So you want to make sure that you check in with that and hear his account of how everything went. And then we're going to have James and David and Andy on at a later time. We're still trying to nail down exactly when we can get John Saul and Clive Cussler on. I don't know if it's going to be November because we are pretty booked up for November, unless it happens to be a special show. We are having on November 30th Patricia Cornwell. We also have coming up Daniel Palmer and Brian Gurley on. We'll be on Tuesday's show, the November, whatever day November is. I'm lucky I knew today was the 12th. So you can always check out, suspensemagazine.com, click on Suspense Radio, and see exactly what's going on. You'll find a lot of different things that we have up there. I do know that the new cover is up there. So people that have voted on the December cover, that is now live, and that is up there. So if you voted for it, way to go. If you didn't, sorry. I lost out, so you can come with me, and we can all, talk about why our cover didn't win. But that's okay, because it's still great, and it still has everything in there, which is Rebecca York and Patricia Cornwell are also in there, along with Heather Graham. We have an interview with her and her Keeper series with Debbie LeBlanc and Alexandra Sokoloff, and I probably said that wrong. So a lot of great things going on. But what we want to do is we want to get to tonight, and we want to bring on our first guest. His book just came out called The Dinosaur Hunter, and this is his, I guess we were talking a little off there, this is kind of his first stab at jumping into the mystery and suspense genre, and he loves it. He's written many books before. He has two series that were going on with Josh Thurlow and the Colwood series, but this latest book, The Dinosaur Hunter, is in shelves to go get it, and I want to thank Homer Hickam for coming on. So, Homer, thank you so much for joining us tonight. How you doing?
Well, I'm doing fine, John, and thank you for doing your shows on the veterans. I'm a Vietnam veteran, by the way, and I guess the book that I'm best known for is Rocket Boys. I guess that's true because it's studied in almost every school system in the country. It was published in Vietnamese, and I got a chance to go back to Vietnam last year because they published Rocket Boys in Vietnamese. And I want to tell you, it was a wonderful experience, and all of my Vietnam veteran buddies, I hope that if they get the chance, they'll go back to Vietnam, because actually you can see that country over there. They love Americans now, and they recognize that we were fighting for their freedoms. It's just amazing.
Yeah, that had to be quite an experience. I mean, to go back, I guess I'm almost 40 years later probably, to see how everything has changed.
Yeah, I flew into Hanoi, and you can imagine for a Vietnam veteran what that would be like. I was met by some wonderful young people who know very, very little about the war. But one of the first things I did was to visit with some North Vietnamese writers. And most of those were older folks like me, and they were there during the war era. And some of them were actually North Vietnamese soldiers. And we shared notes and determined that we probably shot at each other somewhere along the line. So it was kind of interesting. But I want to tell you, it's a great country, and I was happy to be over there. And they're talking about translating now almost all my books in Vietnamese, so I'm excited about that.
Hey, that's fabulous. And speaking of books, why don't we talk a little bit about The Dinosaur Hunter, which, like you said, was your first real stab here at true mystery and suspense thriller fiction. So can you give us a little background on exactly, why you decided to go this way and how the book kind of came about?
Sure. One thing about the mystery genre, and I'm a great lover of it, and I've read all kinds of different mysteries, Dick Francis and Lawrence Sanders. I love the mystery set in Rome that Stephen Saylor writes, and of course the Navajo detective series that Tony Hillerman wrote. So all of those. And what I saw as I read those was, my gosh, the mystery genre gives you a great opportunity to write about a lot of really different things, and always you have as your protagonist somebody who's curious and wants to maybe find out, whether it's to solve a crime or whatever it is, to kind of dig into a situation. And therefore, for a writer, it gives you a reason to go in and kind of unveil things that maybe people don't know, because Your protagonist needs to know this kind of thing. With The Dinosaur Hunter, that actually, about 12 years ago, the director of October Sky that was based on Rocket Boys, Joe Johnston, was directing a movie called Jurassic Park 3. And he was going out to Montana to research digging up dinosaurs and such. So I went out there with him, and three things happened. Number one, I fell in love with hunting dinosaur bones. Number two, I fell in love with that big sky country out in the ranch lands. And number three, I fell in love with those people, these ranchers that are still living the cowboy life, really the 19th century life out there, although they do have four-wheelers and pickup trucks. And I thought, you know, I really want to write a novel that's set out here in eastern Montana that will bring these people to life, and maybe also I can bring out about dinosaur bones. So the mystery genre just turned out to be perfect. So I've got a new character. His name is Mike Wire. Mike is a retired LAPD homicide cop who was shot in the stomach and just had to leave those mean streets. He goes out to Montana 10 years ago when the story starts, and he's now the top hand for an outfit called the Square C. It's run by a real hard-bitten woman, widow, by the name of Jeanette Coulter, whom he absolutely adores but can't really show it. Lives in an old trailer down the road from the main house, and all he wants is to be left alone. And a young paleontologist shows up. He is the dinosaur hunter from the title. And after he shows murder, mayhem, all the things that old Mike was trying to get away from, shows up in eastern Montana in dinosaur country. And the next thing you know, also the dinosaur hunter is solving a murder mystery 65 million years old that happened within a T-Rex family. And I just wrap these stories tighter and tighter together till they're almost the same. And we're looking at a story of today and deep time 65 million years ago.
Yeah, I mean, and when you go to those places in Montana or Wyoming, it's almost like time has stood still.
Well, you know, one of the things I really like to do when I write is to research in depth. Now, a writer has to learn not to tell everything he knows, because that gets kind of boring. Hemingway said, a reader will know if you know it, even if you don't write it down. And I think that's true. So, yes, every summer I go out to Montana. I hunt the dinosaur bones. I've found two T-Rexes so far. There's only been 38 ever found.
Wow.
So I'm a pretty good dinosaur hunter myself. I've learned an awful lot, just probably enough to be dangerous. But I also immerse myself into the rancher's life, and they lead a really rough life. And when my wife read the first draft of it, of The Dinosaur Hunter, she said, you know, Homer, you might should call this The Cow Hunter, because there's a lot in here about cows. And I said, well, you know, they're fascinating creatures, and of course I ended up taking a lot of that out. But I did have to learn everything that the ranchers knows, and so that we really get a sense of what it's like to live in one of these ranchers' families, and then see Mike, who's able to observe the family from a distance and also the dinosaur hunting from a distance. The reader is going to learn an awful lot about these things and also be immersed in a mystery, like why is there now a murderer stalking this Montana county, and what's Mike going to do about it?
And when you're doing something in those kind of times, you kind of have to do a lot more, I guess, old school, because it's not set in like those suspense thrillers of today where it's very technical. They're probably using a lot of old school, detective work to have to try to find, what's going on.
Well, Mike is a reluctant detective. He left it 10 years ago. He doesn't want to have to do it anymore. He does everything, and he keeps saying, why am I worrying about this? It's not up to me. There's a state police. They should, somebody should else should come in and do it. But he realizes after a while he's the only one that's going to be able to do it. So even though he's also been assigned by Jeanette to go out with the paleontologist, young paleontologist, his name is Pick. Pick Pickford. He's out there with him and learning an awful lot about digging up dinosaurs. He's also very reluctantly starting to have to dig in and figure out this mystery. And at the same time, he starts kind of peeling the onion back on the whole county of it's called Fillmore County out in Montana, and it's based on, by the way, Garfield County, which is a real county out in Montana, which is the size of Connecticut, and Connecticut has 3.5 million people in it, and Garfield County has 700 people in it, and about 100,000 cows. So you can the closest ranch is usually 35 to 40 miles away, but everybody knows everybody else. And it's kind of a small town and a great big place, and there are a lot of, you know, in any small town there's a lot of secrets, and it's great fun to see Mike, who's really still an outsider after 10 years, peel back that onion and find all the hidden, dark secrets that exist in Fillmore County. And my readers out in Garfield County, the real county, are having great fun guessing who is who when they've read the book.
And now I have a question here from one of your fans, and they would like to know, how much did you stretch, in quotation marks, fact to fit your fiction? And it looks like they were thinking maybe of like a Michael Crichton kind of story here.
Yeah, this is not science fiction. It's based totally on what I've learned going out, again, every summer for 12 years, for weeks at a time, out in the boonies there, working with Dr. Jack Horner, who, by the way, is the paleontologist that Michael Crichton based his paleontologist on in Jurassic Park. But everything, I don't stretch anything. When I tell you how to find a dinosaur bone, I'm telling you exactly how to find one and how to identify one, how to dig one up properly. But again, I've discovered, I give enough that hopefully you enjoy reading about it, but I don't give you too much. It's not my purpose with this book to teach paleontology. The purpose of this book is to entertain the reader, and maybe if they learn something along the way, that's all well and good, but ultimately I want to write a page turner, and typically my readers say that's what I did.
And now we had Alan Dershowitz on, and he had written a lot of nonfiction books, of course, you know, with his thing in the Laurie form. Now he was saying, and I wanted to know, because there's another question that came in for you, and kind of goes along the same lines, is he felt that writing nonfiction was a lot easier than writing fiction. Now, what do you think? Do you think that writing fiction was a lot more difficult than writing nonfiction and was kind of more satisfying when you finished it?
Well, I love to write. And to me, all writing ultimately is hard because I think H.L. Mencken said writing is easy. All you have to do is open a vein and let it bleed. And I guess that's true. I don't think one is easier than the other. I've written in both genres. My first book was the nonfiction Torpedo Junction about the U-boat wars up and down the East Coast. I researched that. I actually went out and dived on the U-boats themselves back in the 1970s. Rocket Boys, that whole Colwood series, was a memoir. You could call that nonfiction, but I wrote it like a novel, and it reads like a novel. So I've worked in both genres. Both have they're different. They're simply different. But I don't think one is easier than the other or harder than the other. For me, writing is a lot of fun, and I just hope my readers enjoy my work.
And when you were researching in Montana, when you were going up there, did you have some kind of like a preconceived notion of maybe how it was going to be? And then all of a sudden, you got up there, and something just was like totally different than what you probably thought you were ever going to see, and you maybe took that away as like, I just couldn't believe that I really saw that with my own eyes, because you just never knew that that ever existed.
Well, the cool thing about it was I really had no expectations. I had spent quite a bit of time in Bozeman, that's in the western part of Montana. It's a university town, a ski town, and that's one part of Montana. So going out, I expected the eastern part to be very similar. It wasn't. These are the Badlands and the ranch lands out there. The people out there really, they're not cosmopolitan at all. They are hardworking people. They work on these ranches. The way it works out there is that in order for their calves to be big enough to eat the grass, by the time summer comes, they have to start dropping the calves in February and March, and it's usually 6 to 8 feet of snow, and they're out there in the bitter cold bringing in these calves. They work, there's so many people trying to kick them off their land. The EPA wants them off. They want to raise buffalo or something out there, and the Californians want to come in, God bless you, to come out and subdivide their ranches, and so they are tenacious about hanging on to their land. But I was absolutely blown away by the beauty of this dark land out there, and also the beauty of the people who live there. They are people that most people in the country, they just don't have any idea that such people still exist. They are very much still living the pioneer life out there. It is a 19th century life in so many ways. But they do, as I said, they do take advantage of what they've got, the pickup trucks and the four-wheelers. But essentially, they're out there living a cowboy life. They want it that way, and they don't really want too many outsiders. And that's one of the things that somebody like me coming in from the outside had to do, was to gain their trust, because I needed to cross their land to get out to the federal land to do the dinosaur hunting under the license that I have with Dr. Horner. And so in the process, I got to know these folks. You know, I'd go to the dance where the Miss Walleye contest out at the Fort Peck Lake, and there at the 4th of July rodeo, and hanging out in the Hell Creek Bar, and just doing things with these folks, and I love them to death. And now when I go in the Hell Creek Bar, it's like a scene out of Cheers. It's like, you know, where they used to say, Norm. Now they say, Homer, you're back. We missed you. And, of course, this time they're all going to hold up a copy of A Dinosaur Hunter and say, okay, which one's me?
That would be good. And then they try to, you know, that's kind of like the next mystery. Well, I'll tell you what, you figure out who's you, and I'll sign your book.
You know, they're all well-armed out there. So
they are. You might just try to do it anyway.
I try to disguise everybody pretty well.
When you're in a county, the state of Connecticut, and there's only 700 people, there's a lot of places to hide a dead body that people will never find.
Well, this is one of the things, of course, Jeanette tells Mike when their killing starts, is, Mike, you don't have to worry about us. You know, if somebody shows up here, we're all well-armed. And who would dare do it? Well, Mike knows that there are some really, really, really mean people out there, that even folks like that live out in eastern Montana, that think that they, you know, are in charge of the situation. When these people show up in a place like Fillmore County, it's nothing like these ranchers can even imagine, the evil that is about to show up there.
Yeah, and you know, when you talked about Montana on the western and the eastern being so much different, it's very close to like what your home state of Alabama, or where you live now in Alabama. The northern and the southern part are two totally different areas.
Well, they are. You know, up here we're all sophisticated cosmopolitan type of people, and down there is Redneck Riviera. But by the way, we love their ocean down there, and you know, Alabama is a beautiful state, and this is the home of course, Harper Lee and To Kill a Mockingbird, and which I got to meet Harper Lee one time, and she's really a nice lady. Well, she's not nice, but she's sweet. I'll put her in the sweet category. And she said, by the way, she came up to me, and it was for Rocket Boys. I was being honored, and she said, Homer, I hear you wrote a classic. And I said, well, yeah. She was talking about Rocket Boys, and I said, well, yeah, Miss Lee, I guess I did. And she said, you know, your fans will never forgive you for it, and then walked away. I'm still puzzling over that, but I think she might have been onto something.
Yeah, so real quick then, Alabama or Auburn?
Virginia Tech.
Oh,
that's the cool thing.
That
I'm
doesn't
a Hokie
go over
and I
real
get,
well in that state.
Absolutely, I'm a Hokie, and I get to be able to kind of split the difference there. I don't ever own up to anything. When I worked out at NASA, you know, that was the thing. You know, Alabama Auburn, and it's like, no, I'm a Hokie.
I don't
have to take a side here.
I know. I was in Alabama, and I used to go there for business a little bit. And I was down in Mobile. And this is the only funny story that I had, was that. Literally, there was a guy who came in, and I was sitting in a, I think it was an O'Charlie's restaurant, I think that's what it was called, and I'm sitting at the bar because I'm by myself and I'm eating, and across from me there's a guy who had an Alabama sweatshirt on, and in walked a guy that had an Alabama or an Auburn shirt on. He literally looked at the bartender, and the guy was like, can I get you anything? He saw the guy across from him. He says, no, he goes, I'm not eating. He goes, I'm not eating here. Because of him, and he literally just walked out.
Oh yeah, it tears families up here. I mean, they are so serious. I've never been that serious about football. You know, to me, it's a game, and it's kind of interesting, I guess, when my team plays, and I want them to win. But it doesn't ruin my whole life. But here, yeah. if their team, if Alabama loses, Auburn loses, for these fans, it just ruins their life. I probably should write a mystery about that.
You should. You should put a mystery in that setting. Alabama-Auburn kind of thing, because I don't think a lot of people realize how brutal, you know, there's rivalries of Ohio State, Michigan, USC, UCLA, and stuff like that. But when you're talking brutality, Alabama-Auburn beats them all.
Yeah, maybe I can have the Alabama coach murdered and the Auburn coach as the top suspect. And we have
there you go. That would
that would sell a lot of books here in Alabama.
It would. Sure.
Now, here's a question. Here's another question that came out. When you decided to go ahead and, you know, change your direction a little bit and write a novel like this, what was the reaction of your agent or your publisher? What did they think when you first kind of brought this to them?
Well, there wasn't a second hesitation when I proposed it to St. Martin's, who is publishing the Dinosaur Hunter. They said, "Wow, you know, we think you can handle that, Homer. Go ahead." I wrote for them the Josh Thurlow series, the series I've got set in World War II, and this is completely different. But you know, one of the things about me that publishers don't like, frankly, is that I can't be pigeonholed. You know, my Colwood series, my memoir series, that's the one I'm best known for. And as far as publishers are concerned, they wish that I'd just written Rocket Boy's October Sky over and over again. The same thing for Josh Thurlow series. I build up a big fan base for Josh Thurlow, and then I go off and do something else. But that's just me. That's the way that I operate. It's whatever I'm fascinated with at the time, and I think that that fascination that I might have will come through on the written page. And right now, I'm just absolutely fascinated with the world of paleontology and that grand big sky country out there in eastern Montana. And it's my passion right now, so I've got to write about it. And again, I just love this mystery genre so much. And I just, you know, it's great to have Mike go in and start uncovering these mysteries, and that gives me a great excuse to talk about deep time and finding T-Rex bones and the ranchers and their struggles, and it just worked perfectly for me.
And speaking of Mike here, another question we have is, and it's probably, you know, coming up to your next books, is Mike one of those characters that you're planning on bringing on into future works?
Yes. I love this character. And when I started writing this, quite frankly, Mike Wire was a secondary character. And I was probably 100 pages into the book, and I just sat up, bolt upright in the middle of the night one night and went, wait a minute, this is Mike's book. He is the guy that should be telling this story. And I just pitched it all and went, and as soon as I started writing in Mike's voice, this novel just clicked. And I love this character. He's an interesting guy. I mean, not only is he an ex-homicide cop, and I've had to do some detective or some research on that, he's also a vegetarian because he was shot in the stomach before he, you know, that's what caused him to retire. And he's from California. And I would hazard to guess he's probably about the only vegetarian cowboy that anybody's writing about right now. And the people in the county, the real people, when I told them I was writing about a vegetarian cowboy, they said, Homer, any kind of vegetarian out here would starve to death. And I said, well, there's always macaroni and cheese.
That's true. You can always find Kraft macaroni and cheese. Or a good tomato soup with grilled cheese. There's nothing like down an ice cold night, which is exactly what we're having here in California. I'll tell you, it's been cold. Southern California down to like 42 degrees at night. Not liking that all too much, but you can sleep real well in it. So
yeah, I like the cool weather too. But you know, out there in Montana, it's been snowing since September, and so you probably wouldn't get too much sympathy for your 42 degrees from those folks.
I know they'd probably be begging for that.
Yeah, but we have a place down in St. John, the Virgin Islands, so we're going to head down to our little money pit for Thanksgiving and soak up a few rays before we hit the dead of the winter here in Huntsville.
Yeah. Now, since the Dinosaur Hunter just came out, and so I know that you're writing next. Is your next book going to be another mystery suspense with Michael, or are you doing something else? And if so, how long will it take before you jump back into him with another book?
Well, the next one won't, because I'd already signed to write another book, and I can't really yet to talk about it. But I hope that as soon as I get this one done, and then I'll be able to get back to Mike. A lot of people are begging for another Josh Thurlow, but I really like this character, and I want to keep the momentum going with Mike. So how long it take? It generally takes me about a year to write a novel, but I've got all the research done, and Mike is an interesting guy, and I think I could maybe write it a little bit faster. But I never turn in a manuscript till it's completely ready to go. That's one thing. That's kind of my hallmark too. I want to have I have the book perfect. I have it polished before I ever turn it in. I don't depend on the editor to have to do very much, and that's just the way I am. That's just the way that I work. And generally, I hit my deadline. Sometimes I'll be a week or so late, but not much more than that.
Well, I'll tell you, Homer, it's been great. I want to remind everybody here that we've been talking with Homer Hickman, and the book is called The Dinosaur Hunter, available now to go out and get on all the Amazons, Barnes & Noble. If you got the Kindles, you got the e-readers, go get it. You can get it now, and it's not even going to – you can still listen to the show and still go get it. The website is Homer, HICKAM.com. It is Homer Hickam. Not Homer Hickman, so remember Homer Hickam.
Yeah,
all right?
Thank you, John.
So don't mess that one up. And Homer, it's been great having you on. We really appreciate it, and we look forward to see what's coming next.
It's been my pleasure, John. It's been wonderful, and I hope to hop back into this mystery genre and talk to you next time about Manila.
Yes, we want to see you come back.
A couple of books down the road here.
Yes. So you have a great one, and thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
And so, everybody, again, that was Homer Hickam. And that book, again, is called The Dinosaur Hunter. Go check it out at Homer Hickam, HICKAM.com. Next, we're going to bring on our next guest here, which is, you know, with an explosive new book called The Identity Man. We reviewed it, and I'll tell you what, it was absolutely tremendous. And it's great to see, you know, we're able to talk to the author here, Andrew Klavan. So, Andrew, how are you doing? And thank you so much for coming on.
I'm doing great, and it's nice to be here, John.
Yes, thank you. And, you know, I know that you're over there, and you're probably freezing, too, away from California, but, you know, we're still cold here, so it's okay. You know, you could have brought a little bit of the cold over there with you and not had to worry about it over here, so.
John, I'm sorry, you just broke up, and I lost you for most of that sentence. Could you try again?
That's okay. Are you there? Can you hear me now?
Yep. Yeah,
I said, I know that you're over on the East Coast now, so it could have been nice when you left that you could have taken some of this cold weather in Southern California away with us. We didn't
need
it right now.
It's strange. It's been quite nice on the East Coast. It's been very mild fall, and I know I left Southern California. It was cold and foggy and rainy, so I'm a little embarrassed.
Well, The Identity Man just came out. I believe it came out probably Tuesday. And I know, I think it said November 11th, but most books come out on a Tuesday, so I don't know if that date was just a little wrong. But, you know.
Yeah, no, it was November 11th, that's right.
Oh, so it was yesterday?
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's good. So it's out. Whether it was Tuesday or yesterday, everyone can still go and grab it right now. And it is The Identity Man. And so can you kind of explain a little bit about to everybody, you know, kind of your concept of it and, you know, a little bit about the book? Because it's very intriguing where you focus a little bit different on a protagonist who is actually a criminal, kind of. So it's kind of a different kind of, you know, kind of thing for a mystery and suspense thriller.
Yeah, he's really just a petty thief, a guy named John Shannon, and one day he does the one virtuous thing he's ever done in his life. He kind of rescues a woman in trouble, and as no good deed goes unpunished, he winds up getting accused of a murder he didn't commit. He's on the run, and the police are closing in on him. And he suddenly gets a message from a mysterious stranger who makes him this offer. He says, listen, I'll get you out of this. I'm going to give you a brand new life. I'm going to give you a new face, a new name, just expunge all your records, give you a totally new chance. And Shannon doesn't know why this is happening, but he's so desperate, he takes the deal. And it's the story of a guy trying to build a new life, except he's trying to do it in a town that's just been gutted by corruption and by fire and by flood, and he suddenly finds himself in a lot more trouble than he was when he started out. So it's a different kind of story and a lot of twists and turns before the end of it.
Yeah, and you say that that kind of city that he ends up moving to is kind of resembles like New Orleans, and then you also have that parallel plot where you have Lieutenant Brick Ramsey coming in, and so you're working with two kinds of things, you know, coming to way to, you know, kind of end into a, like a, you know, like a explosive climactic ending.
Yeah, it's really about these two guys coming together, and you know, it's called The Identity Man because on the one hand, it's about this guy kind of trying to rebuild his identity, but it's a city, as you say, that's kind of been destroyed by identity politics, by racial politics, by all the things that happen in the worst of our cities. You know, you mentioned New Orleans. It's kind of, it's not quite New Orleans, it's not quite Detroit, but it's a city that's been gutted, as those cities have, by just, you know, bad government and corruption and all the things that take the life out of a city. So, yeah, Brick Ramsey is kind of part of that. He's the cop who has his finger in every pie and who's been tainted by the corruption in the town. And these two lives are sort of headed crashing together.
So, yeah, so what you have here kind of is your book, like I said, really doesn't have that, you know, lovey-dovey kind of heroic person, because you're, you know, you kind of have the petty thief, you have the mystery of who the identity man is, and then you have the good cop gone bad. So you kind of got three kind of things going on here. Have you gotten a lot of mail where people have been like, you know, just saying how emotional, you know, driven that the book has been for them? And I know it's kind of a short time, but I'm sure people have gone out and probably have already read and emailed you about it.
Yeah, I have gotten some emails, and people have been really moved. I find it a moving story. I mean, it is the story of this guy trying to find something better than he's had in the past. And, you know, it's also a story, as you say, that doesn't deal with your usual square-jawed heroes. You know, I've never liked writing about the kind of, you know, square-jawed FBI agent who grabs the phone and shouts, you know, get me Quantico now, you know. That's never been my gig. You know, I've always liked to look into the lives of people and to use very fast-paced, action-oriented stories to explore, you know, human nature and the human condition. So, you know, I've never been interested in perfect people because I don't know any perfect people. So I've always written guys who are very flawed and sometimes lost, and sometimes they find their way and sometimes they don't, and that's the story that that I'm always trying to tell.
And when Empire of Lies, which was the book before Identity Man, how do you think that, you know, the difference when you keep writing and you have to keep, you know, bringing this out, and I believe that came out in 2008, do you feel the pressure because, you know, that was such a fabulous book, and of course with, you know, true crime that was made into a movie and things like that, do you feel the pressure as you go on to, you know, have to keep, you know, pushing and pushing and pushing yourself?
Well, you know, that's kind of, you know, generated internally in the sense that, you know, I want everything to be great. You know, I want everything to, I always want to do the best job I can. The way I work is by kind of writing a draft and then just rewriting and rewriting and rewriting until I feel that I've gotten it exactly, you know, to where I want it to be. So, you know, writing, look, you know, you start with a blank page, you know, so there's that pressure right there from the beginning. And you don't really, I don't really think about things that I've done in the past, but I certainly do think of trying to make every sentence and every word, you know, really sing. Sometimes I have to say I kind of bitterly reflect on the fact that I might have taken 3 hours to write a sentence that somebody's going to take less than a second to read. But I think it's worth it, you know, that's what you're trying to do. You're trying to make every part of it as perfect as you can make it.
Yeah, you don't want to look back and say, I started out with, you know, it was a dark and stormy night and the ship rocked and rolled. You know, you've
exactly.
Got to try to be a little bit more, you know, thought-provoking, because readers today, because there's, see, that's the other thing is back, you know, when you're talking back in the 70s and even the 80s, before all the e-books and everything came out, you really didn't have a lot to choose from as a reader. But now with the explosion of everything and so many other things out there, I think that it makes it more difficult for authors today, like yourself, to have to stay, you know, kind of above all of that because there's just so many more choices for readers to go to.
That's absolutely right. I mean, there's just a million ways to download stories. You know, you get them on TV, you get them in video games, movies, and all that different way, all those different ways. And the book is still, listen, there's only a book can really take you into the theater of your own mind. And I think that that's just a unique and fabulous experience. But it's also, you know, more work. It's more work than sitting in front of your TV set and staring. You actually have to read. You have to think. You have to imagine. And so you have to make it worth people's while. You have to grab them. You have to make things move along, you know, at a rapid pace and still give them the depth of insight and the depth of language that only a novel can give them. So it has gotten to be a very challenging task. I mean, I think it's a task that has really come to fruition in America, because I think in the old countries, they still write the kind of longer, more meditative, slower, more detailed novels. But the American novel has always been a lot faster, a lot more intense, and I think that that's very suited to the present day.
Yeah, and you're one of the authors here that has also embraced the ebook, because on your website, everybody, which is Andrew Klavan, KLAVAN.com, you're giving away a free iPad, and of course, you've loaded it with your best-selling books on there, and that's a great thing. Hey, that's a great thing to do, because, you know, I think a lot of authors haven't gotten into the ebook thing, but you have understood that, you know, you have gotten into it, and this is the wave of what's coming down the future. People in Japan don't, or in the United States, to realize that 50% of the books in Japan are all electronic books, and it's only
Yeah, I mean, it's something that really works. I mean, there's still a great deal of pleasure to be had from holding a book in your hand, and you know, I hope that people will always kind of want to do that. But look, you know, we live this fast-paced life. We travel around. You can carry, you know, 200 books and more on an airplane and never be without a book to read. And I think that that's really an exciting development. And it doesn't really matter how you download, you know, the language, as long as the language is still there. The language is what matters, and that's where the theater of the imagination is created and where it takes place. So I don't see the difference, really. I'm not afraid of the e-book at all.
And now we had a question here that came in from, you know, one of your fans who would like to know, you know, have you spent a lot of time with the police and law enforcement for a lot of research purposes on your book?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I've done that through the years. You know, I mean, it's one of those things that you kind of acquire. I've once vowed that I would never write a book with a prison scene again, because I find prisons so depressing. I got tired of visiting them. But you know, you have to do that, and you have to do the research that makes things work and that makes things real. You know, it's really not a matter of getting things exactly right in every detail. It's a matter of making them come to life. And in order to do that, you have to see things, you have to talk to people, you have to know what people think about as they go about their job. And so I've always talked to cops and talked to you know, law enforcement people. And as a reporter, I talk to criminals too. You know, I started out as a journalist, and I you know, knew criminals and sat down and talked with them. So I knew them too. And I just try to keep that in mind and try and keep it. You know, it's less important to me, as I say, that it be real than that it come to life, that it spring to life on the page. And you need some research to do that, but you also need some imagination.
Now, when you kind of look here at your body of work, because you've had two best-selling books, True Crime, which was a film by Clint Eastwood, Don't Say a Word, which starred Brittany Murphy and Michael Douglas. You've been nominated here for the Mystery Writers of America Edgar Award 5 times. You've won it twice. And now your young adult series, The Homelanders, was just picked up to be made into a movie. What is left on your bucket list as a writer that you think that you still want to accomplish?
Because you've
done so much.
That's a very good question. You know, there are some things that I'd like to do. You know, I would like to write a memoir. I think I have something very interesting to say about in nonfiction terms. And I would like to write more nonfiction in general. I do write some. I write opinion pieces and some journalism for City Journal, which is a think tank magazine. But there are some other areas I'd really like to explore. But I also want to keep doing what I'm doing. So it's all a question of time. You know, I spend a lot of time at work. And as you say, I've got the young adult series, The Homelanders, and I've got, you know, my next adult novel to work on. So it's all a question of finding enough time to do all the things you want to do. I mean, I guess that's everybody's problem in life is fulfilling the things, you know, their expectations and their goals.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, time is always the one thing that you can never get back.
You
can lose money and things like that, but you can never get time back. And I think that's always the thing. As things keep going on and on, people just, you lose track of it. And you're like, wow, where'd the time go? My daughter just turned 18. Seemed like I was just putting her in kindergarten the other day. So, yeah, it's one of those things. You just, you know, you just like kind of lose track of time, without a doubt.
And it, And especially, you know, a writer's life is so based on his own discipline and his own scheduling that you really have to be careful, because you're always thinking a year at least ahead of where you are right now. And there's no boss to come in and say, you know, this is what we're doing today. This is the structure of the project. You make all that. And time goes by very quickly if you're not putting it to work.
Right. I mean, you're probably, I mean, the Identity Man is gone, and it was probably gone a year ago out of your head, and you're now having to go back and look at it, and because you're doing your tours and things of that nature and talking to us, but you're already working on the next book, and that one's probably already close to being done.
Yeah, it's a strange thing. I mean, I kind of like it. I mean, I like when, you know, we have this conversation, because it does bring the book back, and it has been a while since I finished it, and so I get to kind of look at it with a fresh eye. I like doing audiobooks for the same reason. I sometimes narrate my own audiobooks. And it gives you this kind of fresh view of something that you did finish, you know, months before, if not more. And that can be really interesting and really exciting, and it teaches you a lot. You know, we were talking before about, you know, polishing what you do, and when you read it out loud, when you're doing an audiobook, boy, every flaw comes to light, so you better hope that you really worked on it and got it right, because you don't want something that's already out there that you can't change to suddenly fly up in your face and you know, for you to see a glaring flaw in it.
Well, that was going to kind of be my next question, since it has been so long, and then you come back and you start re-talking about it and then re-bringing it back up, and you're like, oh, my God, why did I write that? And I can't believe I didn't catch it at that time.
Yeah. You know, I have to say that happened. I feel that I've come into a really good period of creativity. You know, you start out, you have a lot of energy, but you don't have a lot of experience. And so your books, your early books, are filled with a kind of raw, young energy, but they don't have the kind of experience and polish that you acquire over time. And I feel over time, you just become a better writer. You know, you get better at it. And there comes a point when you sit down and you know how to do what you're trying to do. And it's a very exciting period. And I feel a lot better. I'd hate to go back and read some of my early stuff now, my really early stuff. But right now, I'm feeling pretty good about what I'm doing.
And, you know, the one thing that I think that is fabulous about you, because I first was introduced to you actually with the book True Crime. And I think a lot of authors fall into this prey where, if, you know, they've been very successful over the years with selling books, but like their first book, for instance, might have been turned into a movie. And then it seems like all of a sudden the books they start writing after that, it's almost like they're writing that for a movie. And you never fell into that trap. You wrote... You just keep writing solid and solid and action-packed, you know, great books, and you're not worried about that. But I think that some of those authors, when they find that success, they start writing for those movie screens, and I think it falls a little flat. Have you noticed that?
You know, it's really funny that you say that, because, I mean, I'm a book guy. I love books, and I love reading, and I'd much rather read a book than go to the movies. And I've written screenplays. I got dragged into the movie business. I mean, somebody kind of insisted that I write a movie, and I was, like, shrugging it off. I didn't want to do it. The only reason I did it was because she went out and she actually optioned a book that I loved. And sort of, you know, maneuvered me into a position where I had to do it. I know there are people who would tear off their left arm to have the kind of screenwriting career that I've had almost by accident. But it's the books that I love. And I really feel that way. And a lot of people feel, I know that a lot of people feel that having their books made into a movie is somehow the fruition of their work. It's somehow what they've been aiming for, the kind of ultimate goal. For me, that's not true. For me, the book is the ultimate goal, and the movie is an advertisement for the book. You know? I think of when Hollywood makes a movie, I think, well, good, it'll sell more books. I don't think. Well, gee, now my story has really come to life.
Yeah, and a book like The Identity Man, you know, when you're sitting there and you're reading it, and you've already been in that realm, you kind of, as a reader, you're almost kind of putting yourself and saying, oh, I can see such and such as being this role and things like that, which is, I think, what other authors do. But like I said, the great thing is you don't write that way. And, you know, that's what makes it so entertaining, that you are just 100% author.
Well, that's right. It's really nice to hear, because I do feel that way. There are moments when you're writing a book when you realize that you've reached a crossroad where the movie would go off in one direction and the book has to go off in another. And I know that there must be a temptation to some people to take that movie road in the hopes of selling your books to the movies. But I always want to go down the book road. That's what I love. You know, I want that story to work as a book. And the difference is really intense and interesting. I mean, the difference is, of course, that a book can take place in people's minds and hearts, and a movie really has to take place right in front of you. And so I think there's just a depth and richness to prose that movies just never have. I mean, they have other things. They have wonderful visuals and stuff like that, but they just never have the depth that novels have.
And when you were writing The Identity Man, kind of switching gears off of all of that now, so when you were writing The Identity Man, what part of the book, I guess, when you were going at it, did you just struggle the most with? You just either couldn't get it right, or you had to change it because it was going in the wrong direction. Because with those three plots that you kind of got all weaved into each other, you're definitely going to have a lot of internal conflict to make sure that you get it right.
You know, it's really interesting that you asked that question, because what happened with The Identity Man, I'm a very careful writer. I do very intense and extensive outlines. And what happened with The Identity Man, as you say, there are all these strains coming together. And about midway through the book, they all kind of come crashing together. And when I reached that point, I realized that my outline was not sufficient to the first part of the book. To be just as stated bluntly, I thought the first part of the book had really come out well. And the characters didn't want to go down the paths that I had set out for them in the outline. They wanted much more interesting, much more intricate and deep ways of interacting. And so I actually put the book aside for 6 months and stopped writing it until they kind of revealed, the characters kind of revealed to me what it was they wanted to do and what their fates were. And then I came back and, funnily enough, after waiting for 6 months, it was quite simple to figure it out. You know, it was like a roadblock, but once I was past the roadblock, it was really a smooth road ahead. And writing the second half of the novel became a joy, because I felt like it worked so well with the first part, whereas my outline had just been completely insufficient.
Now, when you stopped for that 6 months, was it something that you read or you saw or that triggered that sit there and say, now I know exactly how this is supposed to turn out?
You know, it was a slow process of I knew that I wanted it to be deeper, richer, and more simple and straightforward than my outline. My outline, I felt, had gotten a little tricky, tricksy, that was using kind of tricks that I'd learned through the years, but not really staying true to the characters. The outline relied on action, and I wanted to rely on character interaction. And so I knew kind of the direction I wanted to go, and it just sort of unfolded. It sort of blossomed in my head over the course of several months. And then, as I say, after that, it was really quite simple to go forward.
Now, I got another question here. I think it's either by an aspiring author or someone who is writing right now, because they would like to know, and I think they're trying to pick your brain a little bit here.
All right.
Do you write bios for your characters before you start putting them in the novel?
Very frequently, yeah. I do a lot of stuff like that. Play around with them, almost like actors kind of do improv to explore their characters. I have an advantage over actors in that I can go over and over until I get it right. But, yeah, I try to know a lot about my main characters before I go forward. I find, to be perfectly frank, preparation, outlining, and character exploration to be the dullest part of the job. I don't like doing it particularly, but I really find it's useful, because then when you have all that stuff all prepared, you're free to just go forward and do the character and the description that you want and get that part right, and the writing becomes much more pleasurable and interesting.
Now, we had another author on, and I can't remember who it was, but they do something that's very interesting with their books. I didn't know if you have ever done this, is if a book club, like, for instance, somebody that's reading your book, if they go ahead and contact you, will you kind of get on the phone with them for maybe 30 minutes to help them discuss the book and maybe where they're missing the point or exactly what you were trying to get across when you were writing certain parts of it?
I would do that. I've never been in that situation. I've never actually even heard of that happening, but I would happily do that as long as the book was already done. I don't like to show anybody anything or really discuss it until it's done.
Right. So if there's a book, if there's a book club out there in a couple months that decided that they wanted to do Identity Man, that you would go ahead and maybe get on the phone with them for 30 minutes and they're asking you questions about, like, why did you do this or, you know, do this, and then you can kind of direct them in the right way.
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that, as I say, as long as the thing is done, you know. I mean, it's very delicate while you're in the process, and you don't want people messing with it or getting in your head or making suggestions. My wife, who is my best editor and always my first editor, she doesn't see it until I've gone over it two or three times.
So now that we're talking about, you know, what you got, you know, what you're working on now, exactly, can you mention a little bit about, you know, what you have coming up, besides, if it, you know, your fiction, you know, mystery suspense stuff that you got going? What's the next one coming out?
Well, it's, you know, I have this, that's The Homelanders, and there's still one book left in that series. The third one, The Truth of the Matter, has just come out almost at the same time as Identity Man, just by coincidence. So there's the fourth one of that, which I've just recently finished, and that's in the pipe, pipeline. And
yes.
And I've got... I'm now going to do a series of young adult one-offs, of singletons, you know, just standalone novels that aren't series. And I've got another adult thriller that I want to do. And after I finish this next adult thriller, which is almost done, that's when I want to really sit back and kind of explore and ask myself where to go from here, because I don't want to just keep repeating myself forever.
So it's very interesting. So you like writing the young adult series just as much as you like writing the adult series.
Oh, it's such a change of pace, and that's just I like that. You know, I mean, I work a very long day, and it's good to have a lot of different things to do because otherwise I would just like burn out. You know, and I really enjoy. Turning from one kind of thought and one kind of character to another. It makes a big difference. It makes the day so much more interesting, as in any job, really. You know, I mean, you want to do different kinds of things. And the young adult thing has been a revelation and really exciting.
Well, Andrew, I want to tell everybody here that your site is Andrew Klavan, KLAVAN.com. The book is The Identity Man, and it is out now, and we encourage everyone to download it or buy it. Hard copy, ebook, however you got to get it, just get it. And I don't think you've given away that iPad yet, have you?
No, we haven't. I don't think it goes until I think it's in December sometime.
Right. So everybody's got to get on and register exactly for that iPad and get on your site. And you also have your newsletter that goes out. People contact you on your website. So very much an interactive author you are with your fans, which is great to know.
Yes, it's a pleasure. I love talking to him, and it really is nice to have him come on the site and read stuff and leave comments and all that.
Yes. Well, Andrew, I want to thank you so much for coming on, and you have a great time if you're touring and doing all of that. And, you know, we wish you nothing but the best, and we'd love to have you back on when, you know, your next book starts coming out, and keep in touch on what's happening.
All right. Thanks very much. I'd love to, and I hope to come back, like you said, when the next book is there.
Yes. All right. Thank you, and enjoy yourself, and be safe out there, and come back to California safely.
All right, will do. Thanks a lot.
All right, bye.
Bye.
So again, everybody, that was Andrew Klavan talking about his latest book here, The Identity Man. AndrewKlavan.com to find out more information about his young adult series, all his books that he had. You know, like he said, he had done True Crime with Clint Eastwood and also Don't Say a Word with Michael Douglas. And The Identity Man is one book that you don't want to miss. So definitely make sure that you go out there and get that as soon as possible. Our first guest was Homer Hickam, and his book is The Dinosaur Hunter, available now. So again, you want to make sure that you check out Homer Hickam at homerhickam.com and go check out his work. Well, it's been a very, very fast-paced show, and we're already at the end. And again, I want to thank everybody so much. Tuesday, we're going to have Daniel Palmer with his debut book coming on, along with Brian Gurley, who is the author of the Starvation Lake series. So we want to encourage everybody to make sure that they're on Tuesday night to listen to that show. And, of course, you can download all the past shows here if you go to blogtalkradio.com/suspensemagazine, or you go to suspensemagazine.com/suspenseradio, or click on the Suspense Radio site, and you'll be able to find it there. You know, we're going to keep doing this as long as you guys keep listening, as long as you keep reading it, because, you know, we do this for you. So we want to make sure that we're bringing you the absolute best in the coverage of suspense, mystery, thriller, horror genre. So if there's something that we're missing, if there's something that you want us to do or an author that you want us to get or that we need to look at, you know, message us through Facebook, email us through our website, you know, however you got to get a hold of us. Let us know what we're missing or what we can do better, because, again, you know, this is a magazine that we do for the fans. So we want to make sure that you guys are happy with it. So I want to thank everybody here. It's been a great time. I want to see you all on Tuesday. Have a good night.